College: How It Is, Was, and Should Be. Author: Andrew Del Banco. What? Teaching, at its best, can be a generative act. One of the ways in which human beings try to cheat death by giving witness to the next generation, so that what we have learned in our own lives doesn't die with us. Consider the original mission statement of America's oldest college. Despite its mercenary purpose, its words are still moving 400 years after they were written. After God had carried us safe to New England and we had built our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and to perpetuate its prosperity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present ministers shall lie in the dust. What exactly? At its core, a college should be a place where young people find help navigating the territory between adolescence and adulthood. It should provide guidance, but not coercion, students trying to cross that treacherous terrain on their way toward self-knowledge. It should help them develop certain qualities of mind and heart requisite for reflective citizenship, such as 1. A skeptical discontent with the present, informed by a sense of the past. 2. The ability to make connections among seemingly disparate phenomena. 3. Appreciation of the natural world, enhanced by knowledge of science and the arts. 4. A willingness to imagine experience from perspectives other than one's own. 5. A sense of ethical responsibility. How? Elite institutions confer on their students enormous benefits in the competition for positions of leadership in business, government, and higher education itself as soon as they are admitted, including those without the prior advantage of money. They get a boost toward getting what they want, though not necessarily toward figuring out what's worth wanting. For some students, it all depends on the number of choices they have. While their choices may seem limitless, there are powerful forces that constrain them, including what their parents want from them. Students under financial pressure face special problems, but students from privileged families have problems too. College is supposed to be a time when such differences recede, if not vanish. The notion of shared self-discovery for all students is, of course, a staple of extortions to freshmen just coming in and valedictions to seniors about to go. However, it's not the same in other cultures. In a European university, including ancient colleges like Oxford and Cambridge, students are expected to know what they want and what they are capable of before they arrive. By contrast, Americans try to extend the time for second chances and defer the day when determinative choices must be made. Why? The first answer is that providing more people with a college education is good for the economic health of the nation. Going to college is good for the economic competitiveness of the individuals who constitute the nation. The second answer is an economic rationale as well, and it's the competitiveness of individuals. A college degree has supplanted the high school diploma long ago as the minimum qualification for entry into skilled labor market. People with a college degree earn more money over the course of their lives than people without one, about 60% more, according to research. The third reason is that college opens the senses as well. Not only the mind, but also the capacity to read demanding works of literature and grasp fundamental political ideas. The alertness to the color and form, melody and harmony is heightened and deepened. A college student becomes grateful in his late college years. Such an education is a hedge against utilitarian values. It has no room for dogma, only for debate about the meaning or meanings of truth. It slakes the human craving for contact with works of art that somehow register one's own longings and yet exceed what one has been able to articulate by and for oneself. It is among the invaluable experiences of the fulfilled life, and surely colleges have an obligation to coax and prod students towards it. When? In a broad sense of the term, college has a history that exceeds 2 millennia. Going back to Aristotle, who identified the years between puberty and age 21 as the formative time for mind and character. But college as we know it is fundamentally an English idea. The earliest English colleges during the 15th century can be described in today's terms as groups of graduate students on fellowship. It later became common for the resident scholars to apply or supplement their living by giving instruction and accommodation to younger students. From college to university. By the end of the 19th century, college found itself in an utterly transformed environment, of which the most conspicuous institutional feature was the new university. In its orientation towards specialized scholarship and research, the university was both a rival to the colleges and, as the PhD degree became the standard credential for college teaching, the source of future faculty. In community colleges, enrollments have soared in the wake of the recent recession, as young and not so young adults seek to retain themselves for future employment. Growth happens gradually, sometimes in spurts, but it puts the collegiate ideal at risk. The size of the colleges has grown by 50%. in seeking increased tuition revenue by admitting more students locally, as well as recruiting from abroad, the college will no doubt continue to grow apace for the foreseeable future. Growth and educational coherence. In a curriculum that preserves even a few compulsory courses, the more students there are, the more the student population in these courses will exceed the supply of faculty able or willing to teach them. Already by the 1840s, the idea that every student should pass through the hands of every instructor became a thing of the past at some institutions, and even the more modest goal of having every student follow a common course of study became elusive since, as the number of students grows, maintaining a compulsory curriculum means hiring an ever larger number of faculty prepared to teach it. Who went? Who goes? We tend to look back at this exclusionary history with a combination of incredulity and indignation, and to praise the present at the expense of the past. Admission procedures, originally devised as ways to screen out candidates from certain social backgrounds, are touted today as ways to identify qualities that may not be captured by grades or tests. College, we say, used to be about preserving uniformity, but today it's about achieving diversity. A brave new world. A quick survey of what might be called the ethical landscape of today's colleges may give an idea of how much work remains to be done, starting at the top. For one thing, many colleges, especially those high in the pecking order, have gotten much too close to the world of money. Today, it is common for leaders of top colleges to garnish their presidential pay by. Today, it is common for leaders of top colleges to garnish their presidential pay by sitting on highly remunerative. Today, it is common for leaders of top colleges to garnish their presidential pay by sitting on highly remunerative corporate boards. At worst, this sort of thing is a conflict of interest. At best, it is unseemly. Outside the elite reaches of academia, many college teachers are underpaid and overworked, devoted to their students at cost to themselves, but they tend to be obscured in the public eye by their more visible counterparts, media star professors who jet around the globe on TV and provide more prestige than time to their home institutions. In regard to teaching loads, outside business ventures, consulting time versus teaching time, and so on, tenured members of the faculty, frequently as individuals, tend to make their own rules. A me-first ethos was destroying what was left of an older civic attitude, according to which a professor's primary obligation is to the institution, essentially students and colleagues, and that all else is secondary. For students, most don't lead pampered lives of self-indulgence. But, as with faculty, the gap is widening between the majority and the selected few. Today, top colleges via for students by offering amenities superior to those of competition. One Ivy League dean recently declared that universities should simply give up the fantasy of holding to academic values that stand apart from the culture of universal commodification. College and higher education. Public discussion about higher education continues to focus on issues of cost and access, including the question of who gets to go to the most prestigious colleges. One problem with this focus is that getting in is by no means good enough. A great many low-income students who manage to start college never finish. The real problem is our K-12 schools, and that too many students go on to college rather than too few. Primary and secondary education doubtless need reform, and they need it badly. Colleges shouldn't wait for it to happen. Whatever elementary instruction the schools fail to give, the college must supply. Not only should colleges do better at providing remedial help to students who need it, but also they should recognize that their obligations begin with prospective students. More partnerships are needed between four-year colleges and community colleges, as well as the collaborations linking colleges with local high schools and community organizations that work with high school students who are hoping, against the odds, to attend college. Low-income families also need help in understanding the rationale for paying education with future money. As for improving graduation rates, children from low-income families are more likely to graduate if provided with settings that encourage close contact among students and between students and family members. College should be much more than a place that winnows the best from the rest. A college should not be a haven from worldly contention, but a place where young people fight out among and within themselves, contending ideas of the meaningful life, and where they discover that self-interest need to be at odds with concern for one another. We owe it to posterity to preserve and protect this institution. Democracy depends on it.